Viruses are iconically challenging to define, but they have genetic material, so they evolve. In the 1980s, the human immunodeficiency virus, HIV, shook the world and propelled a massive undertaking to study the evolution of drug resistance in viruses. On World AIDS Day, December 1st, 2017, we spoke with Dr. Plunie Pennings from San Francisco State University about how viruses adapt to treatments through time. Don't know much biology. Hello, and welcome to Radio Bio. I'm your host, Jackie Shea.
And I'm Kinsey Brock. Today, we're joined by Dr. Plunie Pennings, professor of biology at San Francisco State University. Welcome, Dr. Pennings.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So can you tell our listeners about who you are and what you study?
I am Dutch. I grew up in the Netherlands. I'm a biologist by training. I got my PhD in Germany. My path in science was definitely not straight. I switched my major, I switched university, I started a PhD program, I quit the PhD program, I started working, I decided to do a PhD after all, I became an administrator, I decided that I wanted to be a postdoc. Anyways, so not a very straight path, and in part because I was always interested in many different things and I felt like doing research was too narrow. Mm-hmm. And now, finally, that I'm a professor and I teach and I write and I work with students and I do research, I feel like this is as broad as I like it to be. Mm-hmm. And so I'm very happy to be in my current job. And I'm an evolutionary biologist and my work is mostly on the evolution of drug resistance in HIV.
Mm-hmm. So how did you come to start studying the evolution of drug resistance and evolutionary biology?
So when I started to major in biology, I did it because I got interested in evolutionary biology. Mm-hmm. And so sort of evolution was there from the start when I was a freshman. Initially, I was sort of going into a path of becoming sort of a pure evolutionary biologist. But then after I did my PhD, I was a little annoyed that I was doing research that almost nobody could understand. It sort of hit me that the most obvious choice would be drug resistance because it's a huge problem and it's an evolutionary problem.
So I'm interested because it says on your website, and I think you mentioned in your talk today, that you used to study ants. So how did you go from studying ants and being an evolutionary biologist to studying HIV? Like, what was that transition like?
So when I was studying ants, I must say I was never really sort of an ant person. But after I finished my PhD, I got a job at the university where I worked then, University of Munich, as an administrator. I was running a master's program. And I realized fairly quickly that even though I enjoyed doing that, it was not going to be my future. Mm-hmm. And instead, I wanted to go back into research. And so the professor who was officially running that master's program, she worked on ants. And so I spent a lot of time working with her to run our program, but we also started talking a lot about her research. And so it was sort of the easiest way to get back into research.
Mm-hmm. Ants were like your gateway research into HIV research.
Yes, yes.
Unusual path, like you said.
Absolutely. Yes, okay. Absolutely.
So drug resistance. I guess I'm kind of curious myself, and I'm sure our listeners are too, you know, what does that mean, drug resistance? Like, what's happening when a virus is resisting a drug?
That's a very good question, because we talk a lot about drug resistance, and it's not often very clear what that really means. So in the case of HIV, what happens is that, so whenever HIV replicates, right, so the virus enters a cell, and then the virus's RNA. The RNA is reverse transcribed to become DNA, and then that DNA is used to make a new virus. When that step from RNA to DNA, that's called reverse transcription, is very error-prone, meaning that it's not very precise. A lot of mutations happen at that step, so the DNA is slightly different than what the RNA was. And sometimes these mutations change the shape of a protein, or they change the way that the virus works in such a way that where originally the drug could maybe bind to the virus, for example, it can now no longer bind to the virus. And so if such a mutation happens, you know, it happens by chance, but if it happens, suddenly now there is a virus that can replicate much faster than any other virus in your body because it's not hindered by the drug. And so that virus will have more offspring. A virologist would not call it offspring, but I like to call it offspring. So that virus that is now resistant will have more offspring than any other virus in your body. And if you wait a couple of weeks, it may have taken over the entire population. Mm. And so now sort of all of the virus or most of the virus in your body all carries that mutation that makes it slightly different in a way that makes it impossible for the drug to interact with it in the way that it's designed to interact with it.
So it's kind of like these landing pads where the drug would come in and sort of like land in and block that virus, but the mutation is preventing that from being there and preventing the drug from coming in and interacting with it to stop it.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to see it. Yeah.
Wow.
And one thing I think that's important to realize is that this is always a situation where first a single viral particle, or a few maybe, change because of mutation. And then the big change that happens is that those viral particles will reproduce or replicate more quickly than other viral particles. And so they take over the entire population, right? Without that taking over, it wouldn't be a big deal. Mm-hmm. Like sometimes mutations happen and they sort of disappear again. So there's always sort of it takes some time for evolution of drug resistance to happen and to have an effect. But often by the time that we see it, it's already, you know, too late.
So to sum up what Dr. Penning's just explained, drug resistance is an evolutionary problem. Mutations occur naturally in all organisms, but viruses reproduce quickly and are error-prone, so there are relatively more of these mutations. If one of these mutations promotes traits that are desirable in an organism, say, like a mutation in a virus that creates a mismatch at those landing pads, then that's a beneficial mutation for the virus, and you've got the evolution of resistance. You study specifically HIV. What is this virus? Why is it bad for humans?
So HIV is a human immunodeficiency virus. It's a virus that jumped from other species, monkeys, to humans about 120 years ago or so. That's obviously estimated. We weren't there to see that happen. It was discovered in the early 80s, and it's a virus that attacks our immune system and that kills people. But it takes some time for that to happen. And so initially, when people may not even know that they're infected, they may not yet be sick. The virus is, you know, harming your immune system, and it can spread to other people. So in the 1980s, by the time that we discovered the virus, actually there were already quite a few people who were infected because it had already spread through to populations in the United States and elsewhere without us knowing it, before people started dying.
Mm-hmm. And so a lot of people have heard of HIV, but maybe for younger people, they think of it as this big epidemic that happened in the 1980s, and we don't really hear about it as much in 2017. How did we get from this terrible epidemic that was killing thousands of people to barely hearing about it today?
So the big thing that happened in HIV is that treatments were discovered and developed by companies and by universities. And so between the 1980s and now, the treatments have dramatically improved. So initially, there were no treatments. Then in 1987, the first drug was approved by the FDA. But actually, it wasn't working very well because the virus would become resistant very quickly against that drug. Then in the early 1990s, some other drugs were discovered that worked a little bit better, especially in combination with that first drug, but still not very good. And then a big change came in 1996 when protease inhibitors were discovered.
And what are those?
And protease inhibitors are drugs that inhibit the protease, which is a protein of the virus. Mm-hmm. And those protease inhibitors were combined with the drugs that were already there. And that combination turned out to be very good. And so many people remember that moment because some people were actually on their deathbed. Mm. They had, you know, written their wills. They had said goodbye to their loved ones. And then this new drug became available. And some people sort of, you know, walked out of the hospital like just a week later or so. And so this was like a very dramatic moment when these drugs became available. If you actually look at the data, it doesn't look as dramatic because, in fact, some people in the early 1990s were already doing quite well on the drugs that were available. And even in the second half of the 90s, not everybody was suddenly doing really well. So, but in sort of in the collective memory, there seems to be like really a watershed moment in 96 when the protease inhibitors became available and suddenly people were surviving. Then in the 2000s and 2010s, things got even better. Sort of almost every year there was like a new drug or like a slightly improved version of a drug that became available. And every time outcomes for the patients were like slightly better. And so, for example, one thing that you see in the literature is that early on, say the 80s or the 90s, when they were treating people and they were doing a clinical trial, they would count how many people were still alive after a year of treatment. Then at some point, everybody was alive after a year of treatment. So they had to find a different way to measure the success of a treatment. So you can sort of, if you read the scientific literature, and of course, if you talk to people who lived through this, there is a huge difference between people's experience now, where treatments are really very good. And as long as you're on treatment, HIV should almost not affect your life. And of course, as a very stark comparison in the 1980s and early 90s, when if you knew that you were HIV infected, you knew that you were going to die. And so people were afraid even to get tested because they knew that they were going to die. And in some areas, like in De Castro in San Francisco, many, many people died. It must have been, I was not there, but it must have been horrible scary. And like extremely scary. And the government was like not doing anything. Nowadays, the HIV epidemic is far from over, even in the United States. The number of new infections has been fairly stable for many years and is actually not going down. In large parts, that's because people still do not get the care that they need and they do not get tested as much as they should. And so there's a lot of HIV infections still going on. And nowadays, it's not so much in De Castro in San Francisco because San Francisco is doing really well. And in San Francisco, everybody can get treated and tested for free. But in other parts of the country, things are still quite bleak. And these people do get infected, and they also are not getting, even if they do get infected, they may not get the treatment that they need. So we don't hear as much about it anymore, but it's not gone.
Plouni, you study the evolution of drug resistance. So how do you study evolution? What types of tools do you use, or what kinds of questions are you asking, and how do you approach those questions?
So I'm a computational biologist. I do not work in a wet lab. And so all my work is based on data that are already existing. Sometimes I get these data from my collaborators, and sometimes I get them from things like GenBank, publicly available sequences. And so I study how the virus evolves and becomes drug resistant by studying sequences, sequences from viruses from patients. And sort of, you know, the ideal data set would be where I have multiple sequences so that show me sort of the state of a population of viruses in a patient. And ideally, I would have that multiple sequences at a time before someone starts their treatment, and then maybe during when they are on treatment, and then maybe at a time where treatment is no longer working, because that's likely when I can see that drug resistance has evolved. So those data are actually not very common. So sequence data for HIV are very common, but specifically having data from the same patient before and after treatment was initiated is not very common. Nowadays, treatments work so well that usually once treatment is started, there's not enough virus anymore to sequence anything. So that's very good for the patient, but it means that most of my work is using older data from a time where treatments were not yet as good. Most of my work consists of comparing sequences from different time points and seeing what has changed in these sequences in terms of drug resistance mutations and in terms of other mutations in those sequences.
So what does that look like? Like, take us through the time points of what what the groups of sequences look like before in an infected person before they've been treated, then while they're treated, and then maybe what does it look like when resistance has evolved?
So before someone is treated, usually the situation is that there's a lot of virus, and so it's easy to sequence. Mm-hmm. If we get sequences from the same patient later on, maybe during treatment or when treatment has failed, we often see that now suddenly all of those viral particles share a mutation that makes it resistant to one of the drugs that this patient is on. And in addition, what we sometimes see is that there is not a lot of genetic diversity anymore in those viral particles. So you may look at 10 different viral particles from such a patient, and all of the viral particles are more or less exactly the same. And that suggests that they all come from a recent common ancestor. In other words, they trace back to a single viral particle in which this resistance mutation happened, and that viral particle basically took over the population by having a lot of offspring. Then if you look even later, if you say get data from a year later, you may see that there is genetic variation again. You know, genetic variation is sort of, you know, regenerated by mutations happening again. And so the population may start to look again like it did in the beginning, except that now it has a resistance mutation.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, in biology, we're still debating whether viruses are alive or not. What's your stance on that?
You know, I think it doesn't really matter whether you call it alive or not. You know, it evolves, clearly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it has genetics and you have inheritance and you have differences in fitness. And so for studying evolution, it evolves. Most of the action happens in a single patient. And you can track that patient over time.
And once you're infected for life, correct?
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. There's no cure for HIV. There's been a few cases of people, you know, who were thought to be cured, and then it turned out that they weren't cured. I know of one case, but there may have been one or two others, but there's definitely one case of someone who actually did get cured. It was someone who needed a bone marrow transplant, and they found someone who matched, you know, who was a match for him, who could donate the bone marrow, who was also resistant to HIV. So in this case, resistant means that the person could not get infected with HIV, right? Normally when we talk about resistance, it's a virus resisting the drug, but you can also have the person resisting the virus. And so for this particular person who had HIV and bone marrow cancer or something like that, or leukemia, he needed a bone marrow transplant and they found a donor who was actually resistant to HIV. And so they did the bone marrow transplant and afterwards he was cured from HIV. So they tried something similar in other people, but it's very hard to find these donors.
Yeah.
And doing sort of a normal bone marrow transplant doesn't do it. They know now.
Is that common to be, how is it possible to be resistant to HIV?
It's fairly common.
Really?
Yeah. Although, of course, most of us, if we were resistant to HIV, we wouldn't know it. It's, you know, a small genetic mutation that normally doesn't do anything, but it makes it harder for the virus to enter the cell.
Historically, there have been some awful misconceptions about HIV and AIDS, like how it spreads. What are some misconceptions maybe that you encounter frequently as like somebody who studies this virus that you'd like to clear up, set the record straight?
Let's see. I think a lot of people generally do not know how good the current treatments are. You may know people who are HIV infected and there's no way to know. Like, there's no way to see. You know, they will often take just a single pill once a day and it doesn't affect their daily life. They maybe go to the doctor every 6 months to have their virus checked and that's it. And then a lot of people are not aware that there are nowadays, there are drugs that you can take to prevent infection of HIV.
And that's PrEP, right?
PrEP. Yeah. PrEP is pre-exposure prophylaxis. Mm-hmm. If you do take it every day, it has like a 99% reduction of risk of HIV infection. So it's very effective.
Well, we've come a long way from where we were at in the 80s to today, and you're sort of studying the story of the virus and its progression over that time. So I think that's really cool that you're capable of, or you're able to look at the evolution and understand where we're coming from and where we're going. So, you know, one thing I really like to ask is, if you had infinite resources and time, you know, where do you see yourself sort of going, and find, you know, in the end of your career, or the farthest you can kind of take your work, you know, what would you love to accomplish?
What I would really like to do, but currently I think it's mainly lack of time that's keeping me from doing that, yeah, is to study other systems like bacteria or cancer, and to understand how drug resistance evolves in those systems. And I feel like there's really a lack of people with the training in evolutionary biology who are willing to dive into those systems and to really try to understand what's happening and possibly what we can do to prevent evolution of resistance in those systems.
What is our biggest problem today with in society facing HIV drug resistance?
So I think actually that drug resistance is no longer the biggest problem, but HIV is still a big problem. And the biggest problem is to make sure that people who need it have access to treatment and have access to testing centers. Currently, there are still a lot of new infections, like tens of thousands of new infections happening in the United States every year.
Tens of thousands?
Yeah.
Wow.
And a lot of that is happening amongst people of color. Black gay men are a large group of those new infections. And a huge problem is stigma. A huge problem is people not having access to healthcare, and people therefore just not getting tested, not getting treated. Some people may not even know that they're infected. Some people may know that they're infected, but they're not getting the treatment that they need. And in both cases, it means that these are people that are likely to infect others. Mm. And so that is really a big problem. But I feel like in the United States, if we want to solve the HIV problem, we have to take into account race and class and access and stigma.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. So nice to chat with you.
Well, thank you for having me. It was fun to talk to you.
Our understanding of viral evolution has come a long way, but the fight isn't over yet. We'd like to dedicate this podcast to anyone who has been affected by AIDS. This has been Radio Bio with Dr. Plunie Pennings. Thanks for listening. This episode of Radio Bio was produced and edited by Lily Pennington. The interviewers were Jackie Shea and Kinsey Brock, and the artwork was created by Jackie Shea.
Radio Bio is supported by the Quantitative and Systems Biology Graduate Group and the Graduate Division at the University of California, Merced. For more information, you can visit our website at radiobio.net or follow us on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram.